Yes, I came from Argentina to New York in 1965. I had a Guggenheim Fellowship to specialize in electronic music, as we used to refer to the field that way, that time. So I came with that particular goal, and I entered the class of Usachevsky's in September 1965. And I have always mentioned that somehow destiny, in the same class, it was John Appleton, Jacob Drachmann partially, Charles Dodge, and me. And there was another person, maybe it's not so important for electroacoustics, George Flynn, who is at the university in Chicago, but not DePaul University in Chicago. And so, among 18 or 20 people, four people that somehow continue in the field and made a career for themselves, like Appleton and Dodge, is significant. So, and Usachevsky was kind of the father figure, and he, big guy, will take us under his wing. And so I think I learned a lot. It was a tremendous influence. At that time, I was looking towards meeting Edgar Varèse, but he passed away 2 months later, and I had not even mastered English enough. So I miss him, because he had also been doing some compositions or revising compositions at the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Studios. But I never met him. So from there, I stay about 6, 7 years in New York. First a student, then my fellowships were getting smaller and smaller, and I had to start working. And Usachevsky gave me a job. It was called technician, but my function was to teach other new incoming students how to use the machinery in the electronic studios of the time, in New York. And I did that like 4 or 5 years, and I got some small income. I was able to survive. But at the same time, they let me be like a guest composer. So the pay wasn't all that big. It was important for me, but the thing is that I have a number of hours per day in the electronic studio to. And if we look at my catalog, during those 4 or 5 years in New York at Columbia, I did easily 3, 4, 5 pieces every year with electronics. Because, I have access to the machinery,
Right.
and I have nothing at home.
So what were you working on? What was the machinery then?
Well, it was truly the classical studios. And they had four or five different studios, but they made me kind of, I was the technician in one studio. So you stay there. That was your studio. The machinery didn't change all that much, but there were some significant differences. I was on the studios called, I think it was called 106, room 106, on 116th and Broadway, next to the Macmillan Theater, where the electronic music concerts used to be produced. And all the other studios, including the big Mark III synthesizer computers, the RCA Mark III with Milton Babbitt, they were all on 125th and Broadway. So they were about 10 blocks away. And other technicians, Prill Smiley, Alice Shield, were the technicians in those studios. I was in the 106 on 116, together with Ilhan Mimaroglu, who had been my technician when I first arrived. And that was the way Usachevsky had set up the handling of the teaching. He was the teacher, and Mimaroglu or Prill Smiley will be the assistants to the professor and also the technicians who will help the students for a month or two until you were able to run the studio by yourself. Okay, so the gear, basically it was the U shape with four tape recorders, Ampexes maybe 440 or similar, two and four tracks with the exchangeable heads. And yeah, well, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe two were only two tracks, half track stereo. But the other two units, you could exchange the heads and became quadraphonic. So in total, four or five tape recorders. And then vertically, they have the sound generators, typically again, three or four sine tone generators. Some of the units or additional units were sine square. Then a sawtooth generator. They had high pass filters, low pass, band reject, etc. All non-voltage controllable, 65.
All
non-voltage. Yeah. So you had to do it by hand. Well, there were boxes. You still see them around. Not too big.
A solid box,
yeah. Yeah, a little bit bigger than this.
Right. So that's about 4 inches by 5 inches by 12 inches.
Mm-hmm. Because they have usually a dial,
right,
for the frequency, right, and a multiplier.
Right.
No, not that many switches. very simple. Yes, but it was the beginning of those, the elongated one like those. Like the frequency shifters were already kind of skinny and long. Again, somewhere, if you are interested, I have slides.
Right.
of the equipment I use,
right,
in that particular studio. I don't know if it's worthwhile for you now to look at the magazine Music Works with the Yuzachevsky interview, because there are photos there.
Right.
I don't know. Okay. So the Bode frequency shifter was there, still referred to as Klangumwandler or something like that in German, but eventually became known as the frequency shifter. Okay. That's what it was. Ring modulators, probably made by the technicians there. Jimmy Seawright was a technician. And one hidden and locked under key microphone. You're supposed to ask me why I'm looking at you and why I put it that way. Because they did not make it easy for any user or student to use microphones. I was in shock. I came from South America very interested in noise and using microphones. I didn't have much experience. I just have the need. And I arrived there and I have all this technology, all electronically produced, etc., but no microphones. I don't know how it is at Concordia, but must be similar situation at McGill. In each one of the studios, there is always one mic, always there. You can always use it if you need it. If you need a better mic, okay, go and ask for the Neumann, which is under lock. But at Columbia Princeton, there was only one in that studio. And you had to write a memo and ask permission to use it. They made it very, very difficult. I never understood that.
So even though they started, Yuzachevsky and Lenin were working originally with recordings, they very quickly moved to just tone generators.
Yeah, maybe it was that differentiation of schools, electronic music, as opposed to music concrete. I don't know. But I know there was only one microphone and it was not there. You could go and turn on the sine tone generator anytime you wanted. You could make a recording or play back your tapes anytime you wanted. But the microphone wasn't there. You got to ask permission. Yeah. And if you look at what Ussachevsky at that time, there were thousands of tapes recorded by him, piano sounds, trombone sounds, that much of that went into, that was the research. He was like classifying instrumental sounds, okay? The piano sound, low tones, C sharp, eliminating the attack or playing back backwards, and there will be another tape, all music concrete, all done with microphones. But for the users, for the newcomers, it was put away. I never understood that part.
So most of the work done that you did ended up being electronic music rather than music concrete?
Yes, let's say I accepted the challenge. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do something else, but at the beginning I was a student. And I wanted to learn. And I said, okay, fine. I'm going to learn enough until I can get the noise, music concrete type of sound only electronically. And I did it.
Right.
So if you go back to the first few pieces, Exercise 1, that's why we got that title, which was published by Music Works on a clean version now, 1965, my first tape is done in New York, is 100% electronically produced. But it sounds like concrete.
Right.
Because I wanted that roughness of the concrete sound. So I learned how to do it. And then the second piece was Plectros 2 for piano and tape.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge I set for myself, I say, I'm going to write music for the pianist that is going to at times sounds like it's music concrete. But I will create the tape part electronically as to confuse the audience and who is doing what.
Right.
And that piece is still being played. It's very successful. I got what I wanted, and the number 3 or 4 was Interferences 2 for percussion ensemble on tape, which I have actually started in Argentina before leaving the country, but it was incomplete, and it was put aside, and then the conductor of the Manhattan Percussion Ensemble, Paul Price, we were introduced to each other, and he said, well, what are you doing? Will you write for percussion? So I told him, I have an unfinished piece. You finish it, I play it. So, yeah, and I did it. Okay, someone is interested in my music. And that's directly based on noise. But all the tape part is 100% electronic. But there are imitations of maracas, imitations of rolls on drums, all done. I was learning. I had to learn what you do with the envelopes and the filters and what sort of mixture you put there if at the end has to sound like a roll with a, in a bass drum. So you had to learn a little bit about acoustics. And maybe much was trial and error, but it got close enough. I wanted to, that was the thing. I wanted to confuse the audience. There are moments where the maraca player is not moving, but you are the listener, you're in the audience, and you hear maracas. I wanted that dislocation between the visual and the oral image. It kept me going for a while. And still no microphone. I had to go buy my own microphone.
Or did you go, you went and bought your own microphone?
Eventually, yes. Yeah. At one point, I got a tape recorder at home, on West End Avenue and 99th Street, and it was a Roberts. Have you ever heard of a Roberts? Okay. I couldn't afford any other thing, Japanese machine, but there were many in those years. And Roberts was for a while a big company, but this machine, I don't know if I have a photo somewhere, was quite big this way. But it had, let me see, it had 7.5, 3 3/4, no, it had 15, 7.5, and 3 3/4. I have 3 speeds. No speed variation, but it has 3 speeds. And it could read half-track stereo or four tracks on the same direction on regular tape. So there were certain things you could do with that machine. Mm-hmm. Also, it took the big reels.
Wow.
And it was cheap. So I guess I got that and a microphone of some sort. I don't remember which one.